This is an ABC podcast.
Pandemics can be scary. Will you get it? Will you die? How quickly does it spread? But as a counterpoint to us focusing on humans, think of the plant world. Pathogens spread with incredible speed. They wipe out crops overnight and leave millions starving. Hi, I'm Amanda Vanstone. That'll be a bit later on Counterpoint. Now, they might be science fiction, but real wars aren't. And if that reality occurred, what would it take for you to bear arms? The will to fight, to keep their home, is very impressive in Ukraine. What would you do? And in the climate wars, everyone's telling everyone else what they should do, like authoritarian parents. Perhaps we should be more like caring aunts. But first to the big muscle of Russian oil supplies. The future is grim. Russia's in the news again, and one of the issues that is constantly referred to is its oil supplies. And what's happening? Because of the war in Ukraine, people deciding not to buy from them anymore. Are they going to survive? Are they in long-term decline? Well, I don't know the answers, but I'll tell you what. Carol Knuckle, who's an energy economist at the University of Surrey, does know something about this, and she joins us now from the United Kingdom. Carol Knuckle, welcome to Counterpoint.
Hello, thank you for having me with you today.
Now, what's the story? When Russia invaded Ukraine, there was a bit of a panic and everybody thought world oil prices were going to go crazy. What actually happened?
Absolutely. When Russia invaded Ukraine, you can see how the market reacted by actually panicking, because you can see that in oil prices, when they shot up and they were heading towards $130 a barrel for Brent, which is the commonly used oil price benchmark. Mm-hmm. However, some predicted that the prices will continue to rise to $200, even $300, but none of that has happened. Actually, prices seem to have peaked just after the invasion. Although they are still high compared to last year, they are still hovering around 100, 105 or 110, but they did not maintain their upward march. Now, $110 or $100 is still high, but taking consideration that you have the world's second largest oil exporter in the world, that is Russia after Saudi Arabia, which is number one, being the most sanctioned country in the world, and prices still at that level, you know, they did not go further higher. This means that something else is happening in the market, that supplies did not disappear as people feared, and at the same time, demand is reacting to these high prices.
Well, just before we go into that, let's get a couple of things in perspective. You point out that Russia is the largest energy supplier to the EU, 27% of their oil imports and 41% of their gas. 41% of their gas. Gee, I'm glad I'm not going to go through winter with relying on gas from Russia living in the EU, heavens above. Anyway, so that's pretty big. And then the second place provider to the EU is Norway, which accounts for 7 and 16% respectively. So oil and gas to the EU from Russia, 27% and 41%. From Norway, 7% and 16%, a huge difference. So we've got this situation of the embargoes on trade in oil. We've got a war going on. How is it that prices have stayed up? As you say, there are other factors. What's going on?
You're absolutely right about Russia's importance to EU energy markets, because it's really the largest supplier for oil and gas. And if you look at other supplies for energy, they also play an important role. However, we have to distinguish between oil and natural gas, because although we put them together under the same umbrella, but their trade is very different, because they are different, you know, chemically speaking. I mean, oil is liquid, natural gas is gaseous. And therefore, with natural gas trade, particularly that is coming from Russia to the EU, the majority is through pipelines. And pipelines take time to build, and you cannot replace them overnight. Even if you have the liquefied natural gas, LNG, that can come by ship, but that requires special ports to receive it, and those ports are not widely spread across in the EU. For oil, it's a global market. It doesn't matter where the oil is coming. Oil can be shipped by thousands of ships and tankers sailing the oceans, and then they head to different consumers. And that's what makes a difference in the EU, and that's why the EU decided to sanction Russian oil, but they haven't really taken any decision vis-a-vis gas, because gas is much more tricky energy source to sanction, because you don't have immediately available alternatives. With oil, you do have that luxury, if I may call it. It's not readily available, but it gives you the flexibility, because producers will respond to higher prices, especially from the US, where you have massive production, and the US is the largest producer of oil in the world. You have oil that can come from Africa, from the Middle East, from elsewhere. So it's a global market, the dynamics of the global market that determine oil. And not only that, Russian oil, even though some buyers in the EU decided to impose what we call self-sanctioning, because the effectiveness of the sanctions doesn't take place before the end of this year for most of EU consumers. Mm-hmm. But you have buyers in Asia, the Chinese, and the Indians, they have increased their purchases from Russia since the beginning of the war in Ukraine. So while the Russian oil may not be finding all its way to the EU, it is being diverted elsewhere. And if you think about the Earth, the globe, as one market, as one pool, you can see that that oil has not disappeared from the market. It has simply been diverted to other markets and other important buyers, because China and India are the largest importers of oil in the world. And that explains why we did not have these kind of supply cuts that many feared when the war in Ukraine started.
Mm. I tell you this, I'm still not buying an apartment in Europe and staying there in our summer to get some of their winter until this is really all sorted out. You've pointed out that there are other reasons to look at the long-term supply from Russia. What are they?
Energy business is by its very own nature long-term. So it's very naive to think that producers, they will simply open the tab and close the tab whenever there are increase in prices or decrease in prices. It's something that takes years to come to fruition. So if you decide to invest in an oil or gas project today, apart from what we call the shale or unconventional oil and gas in the US, but conventional oil and gas, if you decide to invest today, that oil and gas will not hit the market before at least 7 years down the line. So it's by its very own nature long-term business. And therefore, if I were to analyze the outlook for, let's say, oil production in Russia in the long term, I have to see how much money is going today in investment in oil and gas projects in Russia. Because Russia is not an easy place. There are lots of fields and geological formations are in harsh environment, like in Siberia, for example. And this is where you need actually some of the producing oil and gas fields are from the Soviet era that require a lot of maintenance and a lot of, you know, constant investment. And therefore, if that investment is curtailed today because of the sanctions and because of the Western companies who have the technology, who have the capital, walked away from Russia, then you have to understand that investment curtailed today means production decline in the future. And actually, if you look at the official forecast from the Russian government, so if you look at their energy strategies published in 2019, 2020, then you could see that under the best scenario, they are expecting production to reach a maximum, what we call plateau, and then decline after maybe 2030 or 2035. But that is the most optimistic scenario. In the more conservative scenario, they see only a small increase in the next few years, but then a decline afterwards. So imagine that both scenarios have been worsened because of the sanctions. And that's why if sanctions are not lifted anytime soon and investors still walk away from Russia, we should expect the acceleration of the decline in oil production in Russia in the longer term.
And should, for whatever reason, that turn around and investment return because of some dramatic changes that Russia makes, it's still going to take time. You can't just, as you say, turn on the tap. The investment has to be built, the infrastructure has to be built, and markets have to be developed. So there's no immediate short-term way out of that for Russia. Now, they've got, therefore, declining exports from that. They've got trade issues with the rest of the world. So it doesn't really look that great for the Russian economy, does it?
At the moment, you can say they are not in such a dreadful situation because they are still selling their oil and gas, and they are selling them at higher prices, and therefore they are making substantial revenues. And that's how they are able to sustain their military operations. So they do have massive buffer. But because of the limitations...
There's always a but, Carol.
Yes, but you see, so I'm an economist. I always give, you know, on the one hand this, on the one hand
that. No, that's fine. I like it. That's how the world is.
Yeah, absolutely. But I have to also think about it from the short term and long term. So today they have this amount of revenues that they have accumulated. What are they investing it on apart from military, for example? They are not really trading with other countries. Consumers are not buying any imports from elsewhere because of the sanctions. So you are really constrained in terms of building additional productive capacity in the economy for the longer term. So today you may be okay, but the longer you are squeezed, the more the effects will be negative on your economy. And already you are seeing that forecast for this year for Russia's economic growth to contract by 10%. That is quite substantial. And also sanctions, the way they work, they are very limited in terms of effectiveness in the short term. But the longer they stay in place, the bigger the pain becomes. And you don't want to fall behind other economies when everybody else is progressing, but you are being held back by sanctions. Then you lose even more your relevance to global economy and therefore your influence on global politics and geopolitics.
Do you know, I read somewhere once on that point about being held back and being behind and having more catch up that I have no idea if this is true, but it's true that I read it, that Aristotle Onassis was asked once how come he'd been so successful. And one of the things he said was, well, one of the things I do is I get up an hour earlier than most people and I go to bed an hour later. And I work for 2 extra hours a day, therefore, maybe not, you know, late at night, but it starts working early in the morning. And those 2 hours extra a day are 10 hours in a week, you know, 14 if you want to say it's every day. And you multiply that out over a year. And he said, you know, effectively, there's a month or something of the year where my competitors stand still and I get to move ahead. And that's in effect what happens to countries, as you're saying, that have sanctions. Everyone's going ahead, and because of sanctions, they're held back, and then they've got to try and catch up, which makes it really hard, really hard. Carol Nuckley, you are a very clear and incisive speaker. You make your point very well, and we're really glad that you could join us on Counterpoint today. Thanks for sharing some of your knowledge.
Thank you very much for having me with you today. Really appreciate it.
After Russia's oil, of course, there's the issue of Russia and Ukraine. And hasn't it been amazing? The degree to which Ukrainian citizens, not members of the armed forces, have been prepared to give up everything to defend their country and their freedom. It's been amazing. What would we do? When the stories first came out that people in Ukraine were doing everything they could to ward off the Russians, a number of people said, gee, do you think young Australians would do that? Do you think you and I would? Well, it's an interesting question. What makes people prepared to put everything aside and fight for their country or fight against an enemy? Now, Scott Atran, who's a co-founder of Artis International, he's Emeritus Director of Research at France's National Centre for Scientific Research, and he's a member of the US National Academy of Sciences. If that isn't enough, he's the author of Talking to the Enemy and In Gods We Trust. And he joins us now from Barcelona. Scott Atran, welcome to Counterpoint.
Good to be with you.
Scott, in a word or two, what is it that makes people prepared to kiss goodbye their family and saying, I'm off to fight, and if I don't come back, remember I loved you? What makes a person prepared to do that?
Well, there's something that Thomas Hobbes called the privilege of absurdity, to which no creature but man is subject. And that's the idea that people will sacrifice for ideas even more than they will sacrifice for their families, which is strange because evolution always prods creatures to sacrifice for themselves and for their kin. But human beings invest their greatest sacrifices and their greatest efforts in ideas. And once you have ideas built into values that people think are worth dying for, then they'll make their greatest commitments. This is what we find again and again. There's also the fact that some people, a lot of people, will sacrifice for their close kin and their comrades, their sort of imagined kin, their fictive kin. You know, in political history, there's no political group ever that has not been identified in terms of a brotherhood or a country or a nation, in terms of a motherland or a fatherland. So this sort of evolutionary idea extended of kinship is also a binding factor. And what we find is when the two come together, when you have these powerful ideas embedded in a group of imagined kin, then people are willing to do anything. They're willing to sacrifice for each and every member of that group. And that's what we find. Now, you know, all societies have values. And in the founding, for example, of the American Republic, there were sacred values, as Thomas Jefferson originally called life, liberty, and happiness, until Benjamin Franklin convinced him that, no, we can't talk about sacred anything. Let's talk about self-evident, which they were not, because cannibalism, infanticide, oppression of women and minorities had been the fare of human history for the previous 300,000 years. But they invented during the Enlightenment these values, and they were willing to die for them. The issue we have now in the Western world is, are people willing to sacrifice for those kinds of values anymore? And we find in our studies, no. For example, people in Western Europe under the age of 30 don't even think democracy is something worth sacrificing for. But interestingly, the Ukrainian war has revived the notion of that freedom and democracy might well be something worth sacrificing for.
Do you think that that response by people under 30 in Europe is because they don't feel that what they now enjoy is under threat or has been under threat? And so they don't take the question, you know, would you die for democracy seriously? Because they don't actually think that's going to happen.
That's
but
right.
Now, with Ukraine having been under attack for so long, the penny might have dropped across Europe. And I wonder if you did that survey again, if young Europeans would still say, no, I don't care.
Well, we've been doing surveys every week since 4 weeks before the Ukrainian invasion and every week since. And we do find a shift in sentiment towards believing that sacrifice for freedom and democracy are worth it. It's interesting that people also think sacrifice for Ukraine is worth it. That's the first time we ever found sacrifice for some place outside of the European Union or even outside of the country that people thought worthy of commitment. So what this is telling me is that, look, every group has values upon which they're based. And these values, once they become part of the history and the moral framework of a society, they go into the background. People don't even reflect on them. People don't think about what sorts of social exchanges, what sorts of interactions are allowable or not allowable until they're threatened, as with, for example, the abortion issue in the United States now is reviving interest in the Democratic Party in that particular issue. And so freedom and democracy were in the background. They were sacred when they were first initiated in the French Revolution and the American Revolution. And now they're coming out of the background because they're made salient by the war in Ukraine, where they're seen threatened for the first time in a fairly close neighbor. Whether this will endure or not, it's hard to say. But there certainly is a shift in that direction.
Well, we can hope that it's a sort of a reigniting, if you like, of a commitment to personal freedom. Now, these ideas of supporting each other, you know, fighting to the end, they've been around for a long time, haven't they? There was some example you've raised of, I think, the Peloponnesian War.
Of Leonidas in Greece.
It's a good story. Why don't you share it with our listeners?
Well, Persians were invading Greece, and Leonidas, the king of Sparta, took an advance guard of about 300 of his men before the Greek states could mobilize in order to ward off the Persians, at least for a time, to allow the Greek states to mobilize. The Greek states were fighting among themselves all the time, killing one another. But they saw this threat as a threat to who they are and what they want to be. And so Leonidas was offered by Xerxes, the king of kings, the great king of Persia, which stretched from the Indus River all the way to the Greek frontier, that he would be made sole ruler of Greece if he agreed to let the Persians be the ultimate sovereigns. And he refused, writing to Xerxes saying, if you covet another person's or another nation's possessions, then you are worthless. Xerxes was, of course, fed up, sent another message to Leonidas saying, give up your arms. And Leonidas replied, come and take them.
I would have liked that man, I'm sure.
Well, he died. He was betrayed, and all 300 were died. They were all given the opportunities, by the way, to leave as the thousands of Persians approached them in the Pass of Thermopylae. But it did give the Greeks time to mobilize and inspire them, much in the way the Alamo inspired Texicans in the revolt against Mexico. And so the cry of remember Thermopylae, just like remember the Alamo or remember Masada, inspired these people to fight and eventually win.
You've raised more current examples, both from Ukraine. One, the people holding out at the Azovstal steel plant in Mariupol, and also Vladimir Zelensky's comments, and they're just fantastic, you know, offered evacuation. He says, I need ammunition, not a ride.
I mean, that's right. That's going to go down
in history. We haven't seen that kind of commitment from leaders for a long time. It's a depressing situation to be in, but he is refreshing in that context.
He sure is. And leadership, which is something that I had underestimated for a long time, thinking mostly it's about group commitment and just values, but it's leadership that raises these issues, that raises values to consciousness and inspires group to solidify. Another case, of course, is the American Civil War, where the Union was losing, but Abraham Lincoln was able to inspire the Union to make great sacrifices. Of course, there was a lot of opposition. And it's true. We found little of this in the Western world in the last century or so. You know, George Orwell wrote a review of Mein Kampf in 1940. The Oxford Student Union had vowed never to fight again after the horrendous losses of the First World War. And Orwell is reflecting on why 70 million people are falling down at Hitler's feet. And he writes that Hitler knows something about human nature. He knows that human beings don't, and he emphasized don't, only want comfort and safety and short working hours, hygiene, birth control, and in general, common sense. They also, at least intermittently, want struggle and self-sacrifice, not to mention the drums and flags and loyalty parades. That is, they want something greater than themselves, something which gives some meaning to existence, knowing, as everyone does, that they will eventually die and even their families will die. They want something to live on, and this is uniquely human. And so the values that we hold dear, freedom, as you say, or democracy in the deep sense, not elections, because elections can lead just to tyrannies of majorities as they have in Iraq. We try to impose them without any of the other institutions that you mentioned. Once those values become sacred, they become part of oneself. They become reasons for living. And you can't give them up any more than you can give up your own life. In fact, you can give up your own life if you have those values and you believe they will endure.
Mm. Battles internationally have been lost because the protagonists for war have misunderstood or miscalculated, in both ways, actually, the will to fight by others. In some cases, they've lost because they never understood how strongly the enemy would stick together. They underestimated that personal contribution. And yes. In others, like an example you raise is Afghanistan, where an American general said, you know, we can give them all the equipment we like and all the training we want. What we can't give them is the will to fight.
Yeah, that was actually Biden who said that.
Oh, was
General
it?
General Miley, the chief of staff, said we can't give them hearts and minds. We can only give them trucks and things we can count, which is just false. I mean, the United States, after their victory in World War II, set up National Security Council. The National Security Council, in which I've briefed several times, includes the president, the vice president, secretary of defense, secretary of state, council of economic advisors, and all the intelligence agencies. There's absolutely no input from social sciences or even social welfare or social policy. And so it's all a matter of rational choice, either in an economic or security sense. And nothing about what values really motivate, except, of course, in the background that our values happen to be supreme and universal, and there's nothing to discuss about them. And so they never take into consideration the kinds of commitments that other peoples may have, which may be counter to our own values. And that certainly is the case in places like Afghanistan. As Mullah Omar said, the head of the Taliban, an interview with Arnaud de Borchgrave, who was the head of UPI. You know, it took you guys hundreds of years to develop these things. Why do you think you can impose them immediately without chaos on us or other peoples? And besides, why don't you bother the Saudis? Leave us alone. I think he had a good point, this one-eyed, who's often, you know, described as a one-eyed fanatical mullah. He had some deep historical insight into, you know, what motivates peoples and what can possibly be done. And we've tried to just impose our values on other peoples, and that has failed. We tried in Vietnam, we've tried in Iraq, we've tried in Afghanistan, and they were motivated by other things, by other values, some of which overlapped with ours, but some of which were strikingly counter to ours. And the inability to see that led to disaster, led to a waste of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, if not millions of lives and trillions of dollars.
Yeah. I mean, you see the concept of invading a country so that they can have freedom as sort of a good thing. But as you say, it is in fact imposing your version of the world on people who may not agree with that. And you have to ask, well, are we entitled to do that? Largely, I think these days people say no. Unless there's a serious mistreatment of a nation's citizens, it's really up to that nation to run themselves. Do you think that's a fair point?
It's a fair point. But, you know, Robespierre, at the start of the French Revolution, asked the same question and said, look, freedom, as the French revolutionaries thought, is universal, and it's our duty to inspire it. So Jefferson said the same thing. They agreed, but not by the sword. It has to be done by the word and speech. But then he changed his mind when the European powers invaded France and said, no, we have no choice now. So if you look at the excuses that are given for invading other countries, it's never really, well, we just want to impose our values on everybody. It's we are now forced to do it because they're going to attack us and kill us.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us today on Counterpoint. It's been a great pleasure. I've loved listening to your insights.
Well, thanks for having me.
This week's rant, oh dear, it's baby on board signs. I mean, why do people bother? Why do they bother? It's completely stupid. What a waste of money. I mean, put the money in the bank for the baby. As if any sentient being is going to willingly crash into any vehicle in any event. The baby sign doesn't make it less unattractive. It's already very unattractive. If you crash your car, you're going to cost yourself money, you might hurt yourself, and any other person in the other car. You're going to try to avoid it like the plague. So a baby on board sign doesn't help. It's just ridiculous. Now, the only thing good to come of baby on board signs is the joke that followed, and that's mother-in-law on board. It did make a smile. Well, if a baby on board sign doesn't affect you, a plant pandemic, that will. If you're a science fiction buff, well, actually, even if you're not, you might have heard of the Day of the Triffids, plants eating everything. You think, oh, that's science fiction crazy. Well, you know, sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction. We have discovered the plant destroyer. It's out there. It's been out there for a long time. And it gets into plants and it just eats them. It's not a bug. It gets in there. It's a fascinating story. Joe Zade is a writer based in Newcastle, I have to say, upon Tyne, because there are a number of Newcastles in the UK and there's a Newcastle here. But Joe tells me that if you call it Newcastle upon Tyne in his Newcastle, they'll know that you're from outside. Just as someone who goes to our Wagga never says Wagga Wagga, it's a giveaway. Anyway, he is in Newcastle upon Tyne. Joe Zade, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the Day of the Triffids, they're not big plants, these things. They're little, a bit like algae, maybe. They go through the air. Tell me about these things. What are they?
Yeah, so it's a tiny microbe known as an oomycete, but essentially how one scientist described me is it's like algae that's lost the ability to photosynthesize because it figured out it was far easier to hack into plants and get them to do all the work for it.
Gee. And this was responsible for the potato famine in Ireland?
It was, yeah. So it was responsible for causing the potato famine in Ireland. And that was one of the first times it ended up on the world radar. But since then, it's carried on being one of the biggest killers of tomatoes and potatoes around the world. And it is more recently, I'd say recently in the last 30 years, started being discovered on trees and causing mass devastation to forests around the world.
Big trees, old trees, really, I mean, seriously old trees are falling prey to this damn thing.
Yeah, I mean, in New Zealand, it has been attacking the kauri trees, which, you know, some of those kauri trees are 2,000 years old. One of the scientists there described walking through a kauri forest to me as feeling like you're in a cathedral. And a lot of those trees have serious cultural significance to the local Maori tribe. So to see these trees being decimated by this disease has caused almost an existential crisis for a lot of people there.
Mm. Now, all these things that we can't see, the tiny unseen microbes you talk about, bacteria, viruses, fungi, protozoa, all of that, they've all got a purpose. They're all doing something to keep the world going around. It's just we're not always very knowledgeable about them. But there's a 4 billion year existence for these things. And it begs the question why we're only now realising that they're there and that they have a purpose and that they can adapt, and they do adapt and move around the world as we do now. They move much more easily on the shoes or clothes or whatever and go and wreak havoc in new environments. Why has it taken us so long to cotton on?
Well, with this particular organism, which caused the Irish potato famine and is now attacking a lot of forests, it was so similar to fungus that for such a long time they thought it was a fungus and they described it as part of the fungus family. They slowly started to realise it was actually something very different. And one different thing about it is that it has no fruiting body. You don't know it's there apart from the destruction it leaves behind. It's almost invisible. The only way to know it's there is by taking soil samples, collecting rain samples, and suddenly you start to find these tiny little microbes lurking in the water in that environment. And one thing that spread them around the world, you know, a lot of these microbial plant diseases, in their own habitat, they cause very little harm because all the plants have co-evolved with them. And all the plants have learned how to protect themselves from these microbes. And they get to this lovely state where the disease is able to take enough from the plant to survive and reproduce, and the plant is able to defend itself enough to survive and carry on. But the problem is the global trade of plants around the world, which really kicked off with the dawn of European colonialism and has only got faster ever since, spreading plants around the world at such an alarming rate, whether that's plants for food or ornamental plants or simply the transference of trees to grow new forests in different places. And with these plants, the diseases are going with them. And these diseases are being exposed to plants in new places that have never met them before. And they have no defenses against them whatsoever. And it's almost like an aberration of evolution that once these diseases arrive in these new places where they've never been seen, they rip through them at an alarming rate.
Mm. Now, you're talking about plant exports. What was the ornamental plant that was exported around the world and managed to take this stuff with it to other places?
Yeah, so there was a scientist called Thomas Young who I interviewed for this story who's dedicated his life to trying to find out where a lot of these diseases originated from. And his leading theory is that the disease, which is killing a lot of the trees, originated on the rhododendrons in East Asia, most likely Vietnam. And then the global trade of rhododendrons as an ornamental plant. You know, it's a very popular plant. You see rhododendrons growing everywhere
now. They are beautiful.
They are beautiful. I was just driving past them recently and the colour they add to the forest is beautiful. Mm. But with these plants came the diseases. And the disease doesn't really affect rhododendrons that much. It just lives on them. So a lot of these rhododendrons were arriving in places. They looked fine. And then they go into horticultural nurseries and then they get distributed nationally around the country. And then the disease starts jumping from those rhododendrons onto local trees. And suddenly you've got millions of oaks dying, or you've got millions of larch dying, or in New Zealand, you've got hundreds of thousands of kauri trees dying.
It's terrible, isn't it? I mean, this global trade is a good thing. It's lifted billions of people out of poverty. But it also carries these, what you might call feral pathogens, out to, as you describe them, new territories, and find themselves in places where there are species not ready to accommodate them. And it's absolutely devastating. Now, we know, you mentioned Vietnam, Taiwan, across Indonesia, is where these are pretty prevalent in almost every soil sample, one of the scientists says. So does it work by saying we won't accept plants from those countries? Can we do something that way, or is there some other way to handle this? I mean, okay, we understand it's got out of hand, it's global, it's gone from potatoes to trees and a lot in between, but what can we do?
So I went up to Scotland and went around with a forest ranger there and went and visited a lot of the larch forests, and all the larch forests in Scotland are now dying. I mean, he described it as catastrophic. It started in the southwest of the country and is now blowing through the rest of Scotland. And they're actually now chopping down larch trees that aren't even dying, just as a preventative measure to try and stop the disease from spreading. And there, a big push now is to start to, and this is a big push around the world, but this disease factor is almost adding a new reason to do this, is to reinvestigate, well, what are our native trees? What are the forests? What are the trees that are meant to be here? And can we start growing more native forests and importing less trees from around the world and importing less plants from around the world and putting more of an emphasis on the native plants and trees that are meant to grow in this ecosystem? Because a lot of those larch trees in Scotland, you know, they were plantation forests. They were forests that were grown to be cut down. And now they became these huge vectors of transmission.
So we can perhaps cordon them off, but I mean, the wind will carry these pathogens a fair way, won't they? I mean, in some areas, in some countries, I read, have sort of cordoned them off and said no one's allowed in. That might be to stop people taking more pathogens in, but it won't stop them getting out, will it?
No, it depends on the type of plant disease. So the particular disease that is affecting the kauri in New Zealand was called, I'm about to say a very long word, Phytophthora agathodicida. But they found that particular disease preferred to creep through the moisture in the soil and attack trees at the roots rather than spread through moisture in the air and attack trees and the leaves. So when they investigated it, they found that that was really primarily being transferred around on the soles of people's shoes. And 80% of the trees that were dying were within about 100 meters of the walkways that were going through the forest. So the Maori tribe there that were historic guardians of that forest decided to declare what is known as a rahui, which essentially banned human access to the forest and declared it a sacred space. And they stopped people from moving through the forest, and this stopped the soil from being transferred. And this did bring the spread of the disease right down.
Well, we have quite a bit of experience here, Joe, of realising what we don't know, namely that we don't pay enough attention to Indigenous knowledge, and its particular relevance in Australia is in burnbacks of fires, but it's all over the place. Indigenous knowledge is very, very important. You know, they've done science. They've done learn by experimentation, don't go on with what doesn't work. They've just done it in real life, not in a lab. Anyway, it's a good point that you make about what they're doing. Let's hope something can be done about this. And I have to ask a final question. Have you seen The Day of the Triffids? Did you read it?
I've never actually seen it. Funnily enough, one of the best books written about this particular plant disease that I wrote about, it was a factual book, but it was written by a horror author. It was the only factual book he ever wrote in his career. He was called E.C. Large. And the way he described the way a plant disease moves through a forest, or moves through the inside of a plant, sorry, was very, I imagine, Day of the Triffids-esque.
Joe Zade, thanks for joining us again on Counterpoint.
Thank you very much for having me.
A plant pandemic would be a very bad thing. and affect our agricultural production badly, as would climate change, of course. But in climate change, perhaps instead of being the bossy authoritarian parents and yelling at each other and at the kids, we should be the aunts who look after things. Our civic square has really become very ugly over the last couple of decades, and in particular the last half decade. It's the you're wrong, I'm right, yelling at each other stuff. And our civic square would be greatly improved if we could change that. One way might be for us to think of ourselves as aunties. You know, the kids aren't ours, but we have a caring role, we have an interest, and we want to follow that through. Our next guest, Catherine Bush, is a Canadian novelist and writer, and she came up with the idea that we should all be Earth's aunties. I think it's quite a good one. You know, we're not the police telling everyone what to do. We're aunties who care. Catherine Bush joins me now from Eastern Ontario in Canada. Catherine Bush, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thanks so much, Amanda. It's lovely to be here.
Now, what made you think of the idea of Earth aunties?
Yes, well, I'm an aunt. I'm an auntie six times over. I'm not a mother. So I've thought about what that role means in all sorts of ways and, you know, really tried to inhabit it and think about it also as a form of action. And also, I live part-time in Eastern Ontario, a couple of hours east of Toronto, and I'm always navigating my relationship to other people's land. I don't have a very big property, and trying to figure out how to love land that isn't mine and how I can care for it when it isn't mine, you know, beyond the boundaries of capitalism, which say that my fence line should define, you know, my borders of care and responsibility. And so what interests me about the role of the aunt is that you don't choose it necessarily, but you choose how to perform it. And it really engages you with caring for others and others who may not be like you, others who you don't raise, but are still part of your larger community. And I'm really interested in how we create these expanded networks of care, both in the human world and beyond the human world.
Well, I don't personally see property lines as being capitalist. I mean, they were around in the days when people lived in little tribes. There's always been borders. But what I am very interested in is the caring across borders. You know, you acknowledge you've got your space, whether it's your property or your children or whatever, but you can care beyond that. It's a sort of cooperative caring, really, in a sense. How's that gone with your neighbours? Do they all feel the same way? Do they welcome whatever you might want to say about what they should do with their land or shouldn't do? Or
no, I don't think so. And I don't think this is just a personal problem, though I will say I have great neighbors out here, and there is a good spirit of cooperation and trying to work things through, even across difference. But, you know, I mean, I live in a farming community and there are farmers who want to spray their fields with glyphosate, which isn't something that I necessarily want, you know, drifting via the air onto my property. So, I mean, those borders do exist, my property and someone else's property. And yet the things that link us are porous, air and water. So how do we navigate caring across that? It often takes negotiation. And I do feel that, you know, culturally at the moment, there's a lot of discussion of freedom, at least here. And, you know, the freedom to do what you want to do. And it's often determined by thinking about individual rights, you know, which does set the border of the self as a kind of boundary line. And I do think it's really important that we think about altruism, which I feel is a somewhat forgotten energy, I'll call it, and yet as such a necessary one, I feel, for our survival as cultures, as a species. So when I think about ant care too, I'm thinking about a way of conceptualizing altruism through human relationships that take us beyond the tight borders of the nuclear family, which have been so central to our, you know, society and the industrialized capitalist West, certainly since the Second World War.
The term, as you say, mother, father, who are parents, can be used, and parent for that matter, can be turned into verbs, mothering, fathering, etc. But no one says auntieing or uncling, do they? It's not recognised in a sense in our general languages, a role that you might play, but it is a role that people do play.
Yeah, that really struck me that to aunt was not a verb. And yet I really do think of it in the best sense as a kind of labor, a labor of love. And as I was saying, you know, in our sort of more industrial consumer society, we, you know, live quite tightly within the nuclear family bonds. But certainly in other cultures, aunts have continued to play a really important role as a guiding figure or an overseer. Yeah, just offering a version of female care that's not what mothers do, that's different than what mothers do. And I think it's really important that we think about the difference between mothers and aunts. You know, that aunts aren't parental. The relationship is intergenerational. It's deeply caring.
I wouldn't be exclusive of uncles if I were you. I mean, in Indigenous culture in Australia, numbers of people are called Auntie so-and-so or Uncle so-and-so, and they're not actually a biological relative even. I mean, you're talking about actually being the aunt. But in a lot of Indigenous cultures, you can be an auntie or an uncle, even if you're not biologically related. Absolutely. Do you agree that uncles can play this role as well?
Yes, yes. You know, when I was theorizing and thinking about aunt care in this essay I wrote for NOIMA magazine called Earth's Aunties. And I do make the point in the essay that while I'm talking about to aunt and how do we aunt the world, that uncles can do it too. And the uncle is a very important role. But what I'm trying to emphasize is that feminine energy of care, which I do think as a kind of feminized energy, and I want to claim it as a female and feminine energy. And I do also entirely want to agree with you that in Indigenous cultures, and not just Indigenous cultures, that the role of aunt does not have to be biological, that it's played by older women. And, you know, women who often step in when mothers aren't available. That certainly happened in Indigenous cultures in Canada, you know, when terrible family breakdown has occurred in the wake of, you know, the violences of colonialism. And non-biological aunts have played crucial roles in reconstructing families and holding societies together.
Do you know, years ago, when I did anthropology in first year university, we all had to do a family tree, and we had to include in that family tree, we had to mark down the people who were biological relatives who were dead, they had to be in one colour, biological relatives that are alive, and then people who were called an auntie or an uncle but weren't. Now, it was a very, very complicated exercise, but it's quite common, not just in Indigenous communities, for families to say, oh, Auntie Mary's coming. She's not auntie at all, but it's a term of respect and endearment, really, given to someone, as you say, who cares. Can we get back onto the land thing?
Yes.
You know, you mentioned about the spraying on the land near you. Are there adequate laws in Canada for neighbours advising when they're spraying?
You know, in rural Ontario, it's voluntary. It's best practices, but it doesn't have to be done. So in cities, you are supposed to post, but not in rural communities where we live, as one of my colleagues at the University of Guelph said, you know, still in an extractivist world and culture out here. You know, farming is extractivist. So those of us who don't farm in a farming landscape kind of have to live with it as a normal practice. But, you know, my point is that we have to care regardless and figure out how to care and figure out how to care across these kind of differences, you know, whether it's between people, you know, differences over vaccine practices or land care. And I really do want to bring this ant energy to how we think about the world. And I was really struck by Naomi Klein, the Canadian climate activist and writer, who when asked, you know, if she should care about, you know, the climate future for the sake of her son, rejected that familial, you know, maternal model of care that she should care because she's a mother, because she said we need much broader and more extensive and more radical networks of care. We really need to start to think about that in climate terms and land terms. And I really embrace that. Also, you know, the wonderful theorist Donna Haraway in her work about making kin, again, you know, the idea of choosing families and kin that expands beyond the human. And so, you know, our family, and certainly Indigenous cultures acknowledges our family may include the land or aspects of the land in some way. And we need to be ants and allow ourselves to be anted too by, you know, I would say our earth aunt rather than our earth mother. And certainly the language is a provocation of a sort, but again, just to shift things conceptually.
One of the great points that comes out of what you're suggesting here is aunts can be caring, but they can also disagree with the legal guardian, if you like. And within a family, there are often very robust conversations, as I think there ought to be, on all of these issues, whether it's insecticides or environmental change or whatever. There should be robust discussions, but not so robust as to break the relationship. And cooperation with others who aren't necessarily legally responsible. I think it's a great concept. And Catherine Bush, I thank you very much for joining us on Counterpoint today.
Thank you so much, Amanda.
That's the program for this week. Thanks for joining me, and I hope you join again next week. Counterpoint's the program where you can hear people from all over the world offering a different view, a counterpoint to the standard stuff you hear. Until next week, this is Amanda Vanstone saying see you later.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.